Welcome to the Halo Health Podcast. We're a physician-exclusive angel investment group that advises, connects, and invests in disruptive healthcare ventures. My name is Jeff, and I'm a family medicine and emergency medicine resident and a Halo Health Fellow. Today, we'll be interviewing Dr. Abid Sarhan, the co-founder, CTO, and CEO of the Halo Health invested startup, Retinalogic. Welcome to Halo Health's podcast, a series on which we chat with the foremost founders and physician investors to give you the deep cuts into the world of clinical insights, evolving roles for physicians, and startup development that lie behind the healthcare innovation ecosystem in Canada. My name's Jeff, and on this podcast with me today is the inimitable Dr. Abid Sarhan, co-founder, CEO, and CTO of Retinalogic, a rapidly scaling startup meeting a massive unmet need in the ophthalmology and optometry space. Abid, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. Enjoying the weather here. It's a mix between sunny and rainy, which is nice. How about you?
And by here, you mean Toronto, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. London was thunderstorms this morning, but offline you were telling me about how bad the traffic is in Toronto, and I deeply, deeply empathize with you, but that's for another podcast. To dive just right deep into things, you mentioned a little bit about your motivations for like jumping into health tech overall, but I kind of wanted to set the stage with your background. It's actually one of pretty deep expertise in a certain field. So can you tell me a little bit about your master's in deep learning and NLP and about the Healthy Child Uganda project, as well as how that kind of dovetailed into your PhD overall?
Yeah, exactly. As much as my experience is a little bit specialized in the deep learning, but also is diversified between academia and industry. So when it comes to my master's, that was like in 2014 where I started this. I was always interested like in health related type projects. So at that time, in 2014, we worked on a project for digitizing data collection in Uganda with Kamuk School of Medicine, with the Healthy Child Uganda organization. And the goal was basically to take big, huge surveys and try to digitize those surveys, but maximize or minimize the data collection process so we can allocate resources in specific areas. And at that time, it was a very interesting project. I did it with another colleague in my lab at that time. And I really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed it more when I had to travel to Uganda to deploy the project there. And I had to meet wonderful people there, get to learn more the culture, the environment, the needs there as well, which made me more and more get connected with healthcare related, but not any healthcare, so like healthcare that you could improve access and decrease barriers to quality healthcare services. So I do remember at that time I came back. I wasn't able to complete that project as part of my master's because of multiple reasons at that time. So in my master's, I did a project related to NLP, natural language processing and deep learning, where the idea was you extract, someone would write a question, and then you would go and retrieve related data, or you will answer that question from data you already have stored in your organization. So let's assume there is an organization that has databases structured or like spread over multiple servers, and they want to provide that information to their employees. So an employee would come and write a question, and then I would go just retrieve that data after analyzing the question, understanding what they want to get in a very automated way using NLP and deep learning. But at the same time, because of my interaction with healthcare-related project, I mentioned to my supervisor that in my PhD, I want to do a healthcare-related project at that time. And that's like where it branched to my work into vision space at that time.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like all your experiences kind of pointed towards trying to improve the quality and accessibility of healthcare overall in sometimes under-resourced settings. So yeah. I guess to build on that, offline, we chatted a little bit about the link between your childhood experiences and your choice between diabetic retinopathy and glaucoma as foci for the next step in your educational process, because you've got all the education. And your PhD was also in deep learning, but this time not on, I guess, using deep learning to gather data or to structure the gathering of data, but instead on retinal images. So can you elaborate more on the specific story that, I guess, the childhood stories and other stories that motivated you every day to work on this PhD and to build Retinalogic alongside the enormous undertaking of what normally is a full-time PhD?
My childhood has been amazing, like, but growing up, when especially when you grow up in a developing world, you face barriers to proper access, I would say, to healthcare services. That can go to vision care, checkups, dentistry, like couple of like barriers you would face. And I was always motivated toward, okay, what I can do for people with limited resources or people who can't afford those type of services, so I can help them access that quality or that way, that type of services. So I was always like, even growing up, I was always interested, like even in the medical field as well, to be able to do to create that impact. However, I wasn't able at that point to do it. But why? That's one of the reason why I selected computer science at that point, is trying to see, can we use computers and like programs to be able to improve access or be able to create positive impact. It wasn't fully 100% focused on health at that time, because back home we weren't focused on like healthcare related, but we that was like the entry. I said, okay, if we can build those programs everywhere you want to use a computer, that can be expanded to healthcare, and then I could expand beyond that as well. So that's where it started. It's more like how I can create impact, how I can reduce barriers to quality access to healthcare. So when I had this idea in my mind, me going to Uganda actually made me believe more, maybe more like strict to my values or what I really need to do, and push toward it. So that's why when I came back, I said, okay, I want to do something related to healthcare, but not, I want something that's related to healthcare that it results in improving access and in enhancing access. So I start Googling at that point. I didn't, I wasn't, wasn't purely vision, but vision was one of the top topics. So I remember I was Googling vision, I was Googling cardiology, skin, three of those, I would say. And then I landed at vision, because of the unique part of it, of like what, of how much also like people sometimes they take vision for granted, especially when you grow up. So I started Googling at that time, and there were like couple of retinal conditions, and me from the outside just Googling and like trying to understand what's going on, I found two main topics: diabetic retinopathy and glaucoma. At that time, I found diabetic retinopathy is kind of easier, or like you have definitive biomarkers that you could go into, and there are like I think one or two people, even I think Google at that time were working on it. And I found glaucoma is more the subjective one, is more challenging at that point. So I decided to go with the glaucoma at that point.
So you decided
And
to
I
do
came,
just the hard thing.
yeah, it just felt more fascinating for me. Like I wanted to learn more about that one, see what I can do better, or like what, how I can improve that. And I do remember at that time, like I wanted to combine genes with retinal images. But due to resources, we stick only with retinal images. I am like excited the interaction between genes and the retinal image, and like the pathway analysis for that and linking to other conditions. But that's where it started. So I went back to my supervisor, told him, okay, I have this idea. This is my proposal. We went over it. He agreed, and then we moved forward with my PhD at that time. And then while you're going with working with ophthalmologists at that point and visiting clinics, you start getting exposure to different clinical practices, different challenges in the clinic, different conditions, different stuff that happen in the clinic that help you come up with an ideas and ways how you want to improve and how you want to enhance the flow there.
So, I mean, walk me through your thoughts and feelings that you had when you walked into the ophthalmology office as part of your I guess graduate experience. Like, what did you see? What kind of motivated that aha moment that sparked the drive to found Retinologic?
Exactly. So I used to go to the clinic a lot because I need to capture data for my retinal images. And the clinic that I used to go to, they have where people get the consultation is different than where people get their screening exams and get fundus images, OCTs, visual fields. So I used mostly sit in the lab. And while I was sitting there, I have the machine, I extract images. The visual fields machine were basically just to my right in two separate rooms. And I felt people coming in multiple times, but they are finding challenges. Like while I'm sitting, I used to extract like few images, and the person's still sitting there and still like trying to finish that exam. And sometimes you have to repeat that exams. So that's where like a spark, like, sorry, go ahead.
Fair. No, I'm just trying to understand. Can you paint for our listeners? Because I know what these machines look like, but like just paint the picture as to what the actual process is and how it can be so frustrating.
Exactly. So that machine, you need to put your chin on the ball and keep focus on fixation point and press trigger whenever you see a stimulus. So people with neck and back pain, they always find issues with doing it because you need to put like this, your chin like this. People with neck back pain, they can't focus. Keep focusing on a fixation point without getting any feedback. You know, attention deficiency. So many people like won't be able to do it. They just lose traction, and you can't really do much about it. You know, like you can just keep reminding them. But imagine senior people. They want to go through this. They want to repeat the exam multiple times. They get frustrated. Technician gets frustrated. You need a dark room to be able to do it, a separate room. All of those are the things that made me wonder, okay, why this exam is like this, and why it's important that everyone is coming to the clinic are doing those visual field exams, but they're not doing retinal images or OCTs. And then I start asking questions. I've met with my advisor at that time. I went and Googled my research, and then I figured out that those machines are very expensive, $50,000, $45,000. It depends.
Jeez.
Currency conversion, it depends where as well, which version you're getting, the full room, technician, all that thing. I said, okay. And I had exposure before to virtual reality. I said, maybe like I think there is a better way to do it. And that's where it sparked it. Like that's where like, okay. I developed a prototype at that time, showed it to ophthalmologists and optometrists, and we're talking like in 2019 time. And then I said, yeah, there is potential for this. This makes sense. And that's where we start like pushing for it and like working on it with my co-founder Julia.
So I'm going to break this down for the audience in a bit more, a bit less of a technical fashion because you're way too smart for me. So basically, again, to reiterate for the audience, you're sitting like chin on this chin rest into this like half fishbowl, at which point a laser dot can appear anywhere, and you're supposed to click a button when you see the laser dot. So it gets quite onerous. So with virtual reality, can you paint the picture to me about how your process or how your device, the company, simplified this process, made it easier for those with neck and back issues, and eases access?
Exactly. To add into what you've mentioned about that machine, we're talking about the faster version. If we're talking about the gold standard version, it's
Oh
a one
boy.
hour
Oh boy.
exam. It's a one
Oh,
hour exam. I had to shadow that as well. I said, oh my God, I would never
I'm
want to be
sorry.
in that
I'm
situation.
sorry.
But when it comes to virtual reality, it make it way smoother in the sense that you just put your headset, you could just lay your back. There is a clicker. It provides you with feedback. It provides you with information about it. if you're missing something, it will tell you, it will speak with you, it keeps you engaged. So it's more engaging. We're speaking with some of the clinics, they're finding more consistency with the results as well, because people are able to replicate the same results because you're removing so many distractions and so many factors that may impact the ability for patients to focus and be able to do those exams. So yeah, the beauty of the VR is just make it more engaging. You could sit in any posture. You don't need to put your head on a ball. You could move anyway. People with mobility issues, they could just use it as well. And you could just run the exam like at your comfort seat and be done with the results and share it with the specialist.
Yeah. So instead of a frustrating process that can take sometimes 15, 20 minutes, and if you're going for the gold standard, an hour requiring technician and costing $50,000 plus the technician's salary, now it's a VR headset that you can strap on and automate. And like, I'm just spitballing here, but you tell me the truth. If I'm thinking about trying to run a kind of visual screening clinic, a glaucoma clinic in a rural setting where there's no glaucoma specialist, this means I can just line up people and have them do the test. And instead of lugging along probably a whole bunch of equipment, 500 plus pounds, you just carry the headset and let it be. And as a result, you've reached your end goal of trying to improve quality and access to care. Is that correct, or do I stand corrected?
No, exactly. Exactly. Like, there are areas like, Jeff, like, especially in rural areas, even here in Canada, they don't even have those machines. They're like, sometimes you need to refer, or someone need to drive for like 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours to be able to do those exams. It's all time consuming, frustrating. You're losing sometimes half a day for that. If you're able to do those exams remotely and then share them with a specialist and then they could review them in addition to other exams, that's a big saver. That's a big, big win. In the developing world, like I was speaking with some other people, they spend around 60,000 in some countries to get those machines. And there are some places, a full city, don't even have those machines. So imagine how impactful, given the prevalence of glaucoma or like those type of like retinal conditions, like, and the impact on those people that you could make.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big win for me.
You talked a little bit about access to care, but I want to drill down to that further. So yeah. I know this answer, but tell me, how often are these tests necessary to provide screening and ensure that disease does not progress?
That's a great question. And it depends, I would say. For when you go to an optometrist, usually their first exam is something called screener, where it gives them general idea. So usually people, when you go to your routine check-in, you should be doing a visual field exam. So you should be doing the screening first. And then if they find something, they will go to the thresholding one. And then with the thresholding one, if they find something, they could track it and they could make you come a couple times. Mostly, people who are, like you do those exams around, are glaucoma people. Glaucoma people, some clinics actually monitor them every 3-4 months. So you may end up like doing it 4-5 times a year to be able to keep progressing. And in some situations, people need to do like 5 to 6 exams before creating a baseline for them because of the subjectivity of it, because people like they want to get used, there's an educational factor. So that's where like it gets like a little bit interesting, I would say, especially for glaucoma people. Other applications could be stroke patients, where basically you could use visual field defects for detecting the defects in their vision, I would say there. So there are like a couple of applications. And I know we're talking a lot about visual fields here, but utilizing virtual reality in the vision space goes way beyond visual fields. Visual fields is one exam, and I know it's the most cumbersome exam. People don't like it. We call it like visual field victim for patients. But there is way more things that you could do on a virtual reality, more than visual fields, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So I before we dive into those, because I mean, thinking from both a healthcare as well as a venture standpoint, the other applications allow for scale. But with your current beachhead, it's just like, if you're able to save patients 2-hour trips there and back. So 4 hours times six times a year, basically, that's in some cases. That is enormous time and cost savings for patients and improves access to care significantly. And I would bet also improves adherence to care, because if you don't have to do that drive for the rest of your life, because glaucoma is a lifelong condition, then that means that you ensure that people keep their vision, which is amazing. But
so there are various exams that could be done. I know Fields is one of them. Even the Fields exam, it's, I think there's so much other improvement that could be done, because now the typical approach is basically press a trigger whenever you see a stimulus. But there are other ways that you could do those exams where you make it more or improve the experience for patients, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. One thing you've mentioned as well, like when it comes to mobility of the patients, when rural areas, but even in urban areas, people with mobility issues and people with limited mobility, they also have challenges doing those exams. But this is for visual fields. When we go beyond visual fields, there are like stuff like color vision, visual acuity, contrast sensitivity. There are also other exams that could be performed on a virtual reality that can go beyond glaucoma at this point, and they can be bundled together. So whenever a patient comes to the clinic, you come, set down the patient, do 5-6 exams, you're done, do the rest of the 25% of those exams, and then you're able to get what you need from that patient to be able to make proper diagnosis and be able to make proper follow-up for them. This way, you're able to screen more patients. You're also optimizing your patient flow as well. And you're opening the door to like more rural screener, because in this way, you could have a mobile clinic out there, do those exams, and you'll be able to expand your outreach for patients.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing is not only improved access and quality of care in glaucoma, but also in retinal diseases, even visual acuity screening, a lot of conditions that otherwise would remain undetected, so that you're able to get access to patients who don't know they have an issue, but who you could make a fundamentally huge impact on their quality of life.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
Exactly. And as I say, like, people take vision for granted, but when you're able to reduce those barriers for testing and they start testing themselves, they will be able to detect those conditions and defects in their vision earlier, which means better quality of life. You'll be able to do interventions faster and also have them satisfied with their quality of life. Because once you start losing that vision, sometimes your quality of life got impacted as that progress.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we've dug now a little bit into the product that you have, the solution that you've created. But I really haven't asked about the founding process, because I know from a long time ago when I met you that you didn't do this by yourself. So who was in the core team that helped bring this together, and how did you all come together?
Exactly. And that's always a fun story for me, because when we started, we never imagined we'll be here at this point. But there is always a reason for something. So I will start with how we started, the reason why we started, and how that drove us actually to be where we are now, given our great motivation. So while I was doing my PhD, it was all, like as I mentioned, in glaucoma and deep learning. I was in some of those weeks, you know, when you're working on your research all day, you're writing, sometimes you pass into those phases, you get bored. So, okay, I want to do something a little bit, I want to change. You know what I mean? And then at that point, I started Googling, okay, like, are there any competitions, any like events, something like this? Because I used to participate in so many competitions before. So I found this competition called Innovation for Health. And one of the founders is still like a good friend of mine, so till now. But at that point, I said, okay, let me go and try it. And I went to this event. There were like a couple of challenges in that event. You select which one. So I went to one of the challenges and I got matched to them. at the end of the day, I wasn't able to proceed with that project because their solution, I was actually building it for someone else. So there was like a conflict of interest, and I had to declare that at the beginning. I wasn't aware of that. And then at that point, they matched me with my co-founder, Julia's team. So with their team, we were working on like how we can detect bottlenecks in emergency department to reallocate resources and try to see how we can decrease patient waiting time, which is a huge problem in emergency departments. I faced that. Everyone had that experience to an extent these days.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure, yeah, you went through that.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And I do, yes, it's good memories, I would say, but it's very interesting. So that's where I met Julia. We were like a team of four. And at that time, I do remember Julia, she came from non-technical background, so she wanted to build that using Excel. And I told her, okay. I had a different approach, which is like implementing algorithms and deploying that in dashboards, showing live statistics, all those other things. So after the second week, we decided that we should be moving to a dashboard and building our own platform. So that's where the relationship started. And we started there. We built our first prototype. We showed it. We demonstrated. We created some traction around it. We actually won that competition at that time. And then at that point, we were four people. We said, okay, that's good. Seems we're good together. And then we decided from that competition, you got money to work on that startup, like trying to execute on it. And then while we were trying to execute on that, because sometimes working with big organizations takes time, we found another competition. And we said, okay, let's participate in it. And then in that competition, let's try it. It was in Edmonton. And like, I know it was hosted by ATB at that point. There were like people from different big companies at that point. And we decided in that competition to use natural language processing to tackle physician burnout, to see how we can detect that, what are potential solutions, recommendation systems, those other things. And we got second place in that competition across like various teams, that one. And then we went to a third competition. At that time, it's Julia and I only. And we won that fourth competition and said, okay, maybe we can, I think we can work together. Like we're getting so much those positive signs.
It was just four competitions, Abid. I think you've had to do at least 10. Like, come
10?
On.
10? Okay, next time. I'll put a criteria. We should win 10 competitions before deciding.
Just start over now.
Well, speaking about 10, I think since we decided to work together, we have more than 10 to 15 competitions we won, I would say, together.
Wow.
And that's like, that's when you come to non-dilutive grant. So we started with that one. And I said, look, Julia, I know it seems we can work together. You are studying business at that point. You have background in kines. I am more a tech guy. I have experience in industry, but it's mostly tech. How about we work together and start like promoting that? And we decided, yeah. I showed her at that time my first prototype for the technology. And then we said, okay, let's move forward. The first thing we did, guess what?
I have no clue.
We applied for the competition and we won that.
Of course. I should have guessed.
Yeah, so we won that. We got our first money and we were like bootstrap. We were very lean. Like,
yeah.
Because my background, I can push for that. Her background, she can navigate some of the competitions. And until 2021, we decided to incorporate. And since then, our team has been growing and we're expanding and like multiple things going on. This better just goes the results of what you're building, both on the business level and the impact level that we keep pushing for. We try not to forget the impact aspect because that's the common shared value between Julia and I that make us like do what you're doing and keep pushing for it.
And competitions, don't forget that.
Yeah, exactly. Free money, what they say, you know?
All right. So, I mean, that's a really interesting story just to see such a tried and tested relationship come out of so many competitions and to have that turn into a startup, which is now accelerating really quickly. But part of that acceleration is due to, in no small part, Halo Health. So when and how did Halo Health come into the picture?
So Halo Health, I was meeting with some of the members of Halo Health for around like 1 year. So we started building that relationship. And then, the advisor connected us with Luke at that point. And then we met with Luke for the first time, showed basically what we were working on, explained that, and then we got invited to the event to pitch to Halo Health members. And I think
And
that
what
was
was the
like end of
timeline on
June.
this? End of June in 2023?
Yes, and between when we got connected to when we met Luke, I think it was in May. So it was kind of a last minute type thing where basically we got connected in May, and then 2 weeks until we scheduled the meeting, we met, and then okay, let's present. And then we presented at that point, and we gained like few interest in that event. And while we were pitching, because of the economical situation as well, we had to take that into consideration. Halo came in and said, like, decided to support, because what we're working on is basically in the core of health, which is basically aligns with the values that Halo Health promotes with. And then look, at that time, we sat together, we did a couple of strategy sessions, we worked together, and then he also started connecting us with his, or like people who might be interested in seeing our technology and learning more about it. And that's where it started. Like, our involvement with Luke has been very close, and with Halo Health member, like, we have a couple of members like Dr. Kalisiak, Tanasi, like there are like few other people as well, where basically we got connected, they saw the technology. We even had an one of the ophthalmologists from Halo Health evaluated the technology and like did like a memo there. That's like where it started. I think the race wasn't very long or took so much time. I think it was in June, and we closed in December, but we only announced it in February. I was
That's
like,
in
it
this
was,
macro condition, that's actually quite fast.
it helped, but also it helped the stage where we are, because when we went to raise, we weren't actually at the idea stage, but we weren't also at the very advanced stage. So we're kind of stuck in between, and we had to show, okay, there is potential, there is a need for this, and people start seeing that while speaking with their colleagues, because the medical field is basically not very big, and like people speak with each other and like talk with each other. That's where the momentum start being created, and in December, people committed. We finalized some stuff in Jan, and we announced it, I would say, early Feb, early March. Sorry, late Feb, early March, this year. And that's it. Like we closed it, and so far the impact of that round has been pretty good. Like we were able to progress. Our team is expanding. We're expanding to more clinics. We're getting more traction across the country.
That's amazing. So I'm gonna kind of try to dig deeper into your experience with Halo Health. So you mentioned strategic meetings, strategic support from Luke. Can you delve a bit deeper into that and how that changed kind of the direction or the way that you presented retinologic to investors or even to physicians or optometrists?
So there are various ways you could present. Like for me, when I was presenting, I was focused more on the deepness of the solution. But when you're speaking with clinicians, you also wanna focus on how that can benefit their patient flow. How can that optimize their patient flow and make it like faster, smoother, address their needs? Like something we discovered, like the technician turnaround in some of those clinics. How we can optimize the patient, where the patient sits in the clinic. And we had to do some studies about that to be able to see, okay, where we're optimizing, where we're learning as well to improve that. We also learned, we had to learn how to work with ophthalmologists, optometrists, what they are looking for, especially with the new technologies coming out, and how you can motivate them to use it and try it. And once they try it, they got attached into it, and they don't wanna leave it. And this is actually happening in clinic. Like some clinics because we had like free trial type program. When the free trial ended, we went to take the device, and they said like, "No, we want to keep it. We want this device. It helping us a lot," and like that type of validation. So speaking with Halo Health members, advisors there, it helped shaping part of that, and it also helped expanding or widening the network as well to be able to meet visionary people who are they are medical, but they also want to invest in the future, and also be able to get that access to more clinics and be able to utilize or deploy the technology and get more feedback on it.
So there are two points that I want to talk about after this, but I want to emphasize that, like, to the listener quite a bit, because you know this well. Procurement, or the way that healthcare organizations buy stuff, is hard. In Canada, in a public system, it takes so much to get uptake because that's just how we run things here. And being able to speak in a way and to build processes in a way in which you get uptake and validation, like you got from the practitioners not wanting you to take the headset away, that in itself must have been so useful for you to be able to grow quickly instead of trying to run to roadblock after roadblock after roadblock and have that, what I call proof of conceptitis, that proof concept that never actually turns into something else. So like that was amazing to see how, I guess, your trajectory has been changed to some extent through that. Now, you mentioned connections. Is there a particular connection that was made through Halo Health that you think really fondly upon?
That's a great question. Like, we got connections through organizations. I'm not gonna go into like details of names at this point, but there are like couple of organizations that we got connected with that will help actually like shape how we deliver. And those organizations are basically focused on impact and improving delivery for access. One of our advisors now, she's also like a Halo Health member. She came. So our first interaction with her was basically through doing that investment memo. Like, Halo Health will bring someone to evaluate the technology, make sure someone specialized to know, okay, how good is this? Is this something that really works in the clinic? So as a way for of due diligence. So she came, she saw the technology, she evaluated it, and then after that she was very excited and welcome as an advisor at that point. So she came like fully on board on that one. So that's basically the connection. There are like few other connections that they are that they have network within ophthalmology and optometry that are also connecting us with their own network, I'll say. It's just the uniqueness of how Halo Health operate, which is like unique over other organizations, because it's focused on medical doctor and health and help you spread through that network in Canada.
And I think that's something I want to emphasize too, because I share this story with everyone, but I grew up in a like in a community that ended up producing a lot of engineers, and these engineers ended up either founding startups or working for companies, which all moved to the States.
It is getting a trend now.
It's a massive trend because it's so difficult to move past proof of concept here in Canada. But you've bucked the trend, which is incredibly important. And to see the role that physicians have had in pushing that forward is incredibly important. And that investment memo, being able to have written demonstration of clinical validation, as well as a deep dive into market sizing, as well as other important attributes of your startup, must have been important in terms of completing the raise as well. So, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the past when it comes to, I guess, your experiences working with Halo Health overall. What excites you about continuing this relationship?
So I would say the relationship is like long lasting in the sense that because we are in the field in the medical field, the relationship will start to keep going and getting closer and closer because of the nature of what you do and because of the support we receive. Like, Luke has been great, I would say, in providing that support, and I do envision that relationship to keep continuing as we're moving forward, because of what we're doing. We are in the medical field, and it makes so much sense to be also be working with Halo because of the connection, the impact they do on the investment community as well in that field, in that regard. And being able to bring visionary specialists to see and try what we are doing and support the value they are promoting for, so like innovation and like forward thinking in the medical field.
So I'm gonna actually just re-emphasize the speed with which you raised. In my deal flow that I've seen companies raising for like a year or more now, just because again the macroeconomic conditions aren't great overall, and you raised in 6 months. There's something to be said about that. But the doctor in me is really happy because that means that you get to focus back on empowering your team to serve patients quickly. So I want to talk a little bit about that because it's great and all to be able to deliver healthcare innovations in a startup ecosystem, but what's not emphasized enough is the stories of the patient impact. And you told me some of these stories offline. So what are your favorite patient stories that demonstrate the impact of your device?
Oh, there are like few of them, I would say. Trying to remember one, like one of the patients one time in one of the clinics, they actually tried our technology, and they sent an email to the specialist at that time, convincing them how that would be a good investment for their clinic. That's one. Another clinic, they were basically they tell the specialist that next time I'm only doing this exam on this machine. Because they kind of they not kind of they enjoy it. It's like less, more smooth, better user experience. The way that we developed our platform, we developed like in a smooth way. Once you start using it, it's just it's very straightforward for people. We had this another patient as well. They used to drive like for around 1.5 hour, 1 hour. Every couple months, and they used to go to the clinic, do this exam, and basically have to stay for 1 hour just to repeat the exam multiple times because they are getting unreliable results. It's I even myself sometimes like it's a lot, you know? So that she was very fascinated. She was like, "Oh my God, like I need this every time. Like I don't want to do that." This exam of that machine anymore because this technology is way better. I'm getting the same results, same reliability. I want to keep using this. And the doctor was happy. She was happy. She actually even like was very vocal about it. She even wrote like a post about it, about that one. Those are like the ones on top of my head now that shows the importance and the impact that this technology can do. Some people may say, oh, senior people may not be familiar with VR, but you would be surprised when we go and try it on senior people. They get very excited because you're kind of integrating them in the future where they didn't really experience before, and it's very easy for them, and they get like off the spot. We had like all the seniors that we've been with, or like we test the technology on from the first time. They never used the VR. The first time they know how to use the technology and they know how to do the exam. So all of those tell you or show you like there is a huge room for this technology to be utilized beyond fields to support people with vision deficiency or vision defects and go beyond that, I'd say. You're just gonna try it. You just wanna go, okay, I have this, I wanna just go and try it and see. If it's working, it's working. If it's not, okay, why it's not working, how I can improve it. That's like a few story. I don't know if I missed anyone, but that's like the ones, the three or four top of my head. We had one more. We had people like who's like 104 years old, 105 years old, trying the technology, and they're like also very happy of it. Like I could stay for longer periods speaking about some of those stories with you, or just the impact I
Yeah,
can
so
create.
all those patient stories certainly are they are a testament to the impact that you're making. And I'm glad that you're experiencing the validation of what you built in terms of its impact on delivery of patient care. And I can attest to it. When you help people live better lives and better quality of life, there's nothing like it, right? It's great to be able to raise and build a company, but if you actually see it, its impact on how you can help someone be happier, healthier, interact with their world better for the time that they do have, that's just something special. And I think it's something that is just quite unique. So, to dive back into the more, I guess, startup founder space, we've taken a little bit to learn about your device, the impact that it's made, Halo Health's role. But I want to ask you a question a bit more directly. What are you most proud of when it comes to your team's accomplishments to date, perhaps most recently?
That's a great question. With the pace that we're moving in, there's almost every week something I'm proud of with my team. Like if you see our team, because we're all cohesive, like it's more like a family. Everyone is kind of like feels belong and feels attached to what we're doing and share values. So every week there's something from improving the exams, from adding new exams. Like just recently, we added another exam onto the platform, for instance. So I am proud of what the team has been able to achieve so far, especially on the precision aspect once it comes to those fields and the quick turnaround for keep improving and enhancing the platform. Like I can't narrow it down to only one thing because every week there's something. Every week there's something happening, pushing us forward, and that week is contributing to our success now and our like push now and creating that impact and that positive experience with the clinics so far. So I wish if I had only one thing, but it's kind of every week. Every week there's something, and every week there is a milestone we're hitting that help us achieve and build our success.
So I imagine in the future, if you do have kids, you'll say, "I don't have favorite children. You are all are my favorite children. I'm so proud of you. Accomplish something every week."
Every week, exactly. Every week,
Every week.
go study, do stuff. Yeah. But yeah, like so far, we have like five different exams on the platforms, like groups of exam. Each exam have like six to seven different permutations. Those like what we achieved so far. Like that's like basically where the hard work for everyone results in this output.
Absolutely. So to zoom out even further, what advice do you have for fellow healthcare startup founders in the healthcare space who are raising?
That's a great point. There are a couple of ways, a couple of things that can be done there. I would say don't be afraid of trying. Just keep trying. Like you don't really need to have a perfect plan for everything. You can't really have a perfect plan for everything because in the startup world, at least to what I faced so far, everything moves very fast and every week could be different than the rest one. I would say just go try it. And don't be afraid to say no for people. Like if someone trying to imply something or like to tell you something, just say no. If you think it doesn't fit or if you think it doesn't work, just say no and explain why this doesn't work for your business. So I would say two things, three things I would say. Don't be afraid of trying. Just keep pushing for trying. Stand out for what you think is good and elaborate on that. And if you can do sales, do sales. That's
Fair enough.
the third thing because investors, they want to see traction, they want to see momentum, and each startup is different. When you're talking about software, it's different than deep tech, it's different than a third different category. So it depends on your situation or where you place. Try to create more and more traction for your investors so you can see the value in that.
Absolutely. Okay. And then for the last question, how can the listeners best help you?
That's an amazing question. By sharing our story. If you know, by sharing our story with your community, if you have questions about what you're doing, or if you feel there's something that relates to you, reach out to us. If you have any feedback, any within your network, you think it's a good match to be conducted with, we're happy to do that. So this is basically what I think would be a good help and support. It's all about the network and all about how you can create those connections, meaningful connections, and shared values.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for taking the time, Abed. It was really nice chatting with you again, and I hope that you enjoyed the conversation.
Amazing. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for hosting me, and appreciate all your questions. Very, very great questions.